From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
I'm Benji Jones, a senior environmental reporter at Vox, sitting in for Sean Illing. I write about climate change and the environment, and today I've got some good news. The panda is no longer endangered. I'm talking about those black and white bears that live in China and eat bamboo and are extremely cute. In 2021, China announced that the bears had been downgraded from endangered to vulnerable, a less worrisome category, after decades of conservation efforts. This is a big deal. Pandas are not only cute, but iconic. They've come to represent threatened wild animals everywhere, which basically means that the very symbol of endangered species is no longer endangered. But I also have some less good news. While everyone was busy saving pandas, the rest of nature kind of fell apart. Ecosystems like coral reefs and tropical forests are collapsing. Animals are now going extinct at an unprecedented rate. It's frankly depressing. I'm not saying that panda conservation is somehow to blame for the downfall of nature. But as some experts see it, the model of conservation that's helped pandas hasn't actually worked to sustain biodiversity at large. Is there another way that we should be doing conservation? I mean, what is it exactly that we're trying to save in the first place? And why? I'm Benji Jones, and this is The Gray Area. My guest today is Jason Gilchrist, an ecologist at Edinburgh Napier University in Scotland. Jason is a wildlife guy. He's devoted much of his life to conservation, working with well-known animals like chimpanzees and rhinos, but also with ones that you might not have heard of, like the banded mongoose. They're small African carnivores. I first talked to him while I was writing a story about pandas a few months ago, and how we reeled these animals back from the brink of extinction in the face of these broad declines of biodiversity. He can talk for days about ecosystems and what makes them tick, but he also thinks deeply about what works and also what doesn't to sustain them. He has a lot to say and a thoughtful critique of the movement to conserve nature, and I was eager to talk to him again and hear more about it. How long have you been an ecologist?
Oh, that is a good question. Well, at what moment did I become an ecologist? Yeah.
I guess that's like a philosophical question.
It is, isn't it? So I could answer it philosophically by saying I have been an ecologist for as long as I can remember. So I can thank my late father for that. He loved the outdoors and he was great at exploring and going for walks and enjoying nature. And so I grew up with that and my entire life has been orientated towards enjoying and trying to understand the natural world better.
That's lovely. We're going to get back to pandas, but I want to start by talking about another creature, one that's maybe a little bit less popular, but that you know very well, and that is the banded mongoose. Can you tell us what the banded mongoose is and where they live?
Absolutely, I can. Yeah. So I should be clear here, I didn't grow up wanting to be a banded mongoose as a researcher. That might not surprise anybody. But I grew up with an interest in ecology and evolution. And I was particularly interested in doing my research on the banded mongoose because mongooses are small carnivorous mammals. There are a diversity of different species across Africa and Asia. Most of the species are solitary, so individuals live alone and they get together for breeding purposes. Hmm. But the banded mongoose is one of a few mongoose species which are social. So they live in groups and those groups can get quite large. So when you get animals that choose to group, to live together and to cooperate in doing things, that raises all sorts of interesting ecological and evolutionary questions.
And what are some of those questions?
Well, thinking about what are the costs and benefits of living in groups versus not living in groups, or where you have species like banded mongooses where they simply aren't ever living alone, you're looking at groups of different sizes, again, to get this insight into what are the benefits and the costs of doing so. So are there benefits in terms of finding food? Are there benefits in terms of holding territories? Are there benefits in terms of reducing predation incidences and predation pressure? But the additionally interesting aspect of the social mongooses is that they engage in something called cooperative breeding. And what that basically means is that adult individuals within the group help to look after each other's offspring or young.
Wow.
And again, that's a really interesting thing.
So it's like the whole family is involved in raising kids?
Yeah.
What draws you to understanding natural systems like this? Like, why is it so useful to know how different animals raise their kids, for example?
I suppose there's two conceptual answers to that question. One is, I just find it intrinsically interesting. We live on an incredible planet in terms of the biodiversity that we're surrounded by. That biodiversity is the sum total of all the species, of all taxonomic branches on planet Earth. And each one of those species is unique, okay, in terms of where they live, in terms of what they eat, in terms of what they do. And they're all making contributions to the ecosystems and the function of the ecosystems that inhabit planet Earth. And so, to my mind, I just have this, as I think we all do intrinsically, I suppose just in people like me, it perhaps becomes more to the fore than it does in others, but just interested in understanding why things are the way that they are, or why a banded mongoose has come to be what a banded mongoose is. How do they influence and how are they influenced by the abiotic environment that's around them, but also the biotic environment? How do they affect the habitat? How does the habitat and the other animals that live in that habitat affect them?
Yeah, and they're cute.
Yeah, I suppose there's that as well, yeah.
So most people maybe don't think of the banded mongoose as a, quote, charismatic species, one that's super popular, whereas something like a chimpanzee or a panda, as I was talking about in the intro, are kind of your highly popular, very famous animals. And so I guess my question for you is just, why are some species more charismatic or popular than others?
Yeah, so what we're talking about is taxonomic bias.
Huh, what is that word?
So taxonomy is the classification, the identification of different species of animal and the other organisms that are out there as well. So plants and fungi and microorganisms. So taxonomic bias refers to the fact that we, as the human species, tend to place more effort in studying, researching, understanding, and caring about species that we're more closely related to and or that we perceive as being more useful to us. To come back to your question about why do people generally know more about and care more about chimpanzees than banded mongooses, the sort of psychological explanation for that is because we are drawn towards animals that are more similar to us, and we relate and associate more to chimpanzees than we do to a mongoose, unless you've spent many years studying mongooses, in which case you're a bit weird like me.
You're a mongoose person.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
More towards mongooses than chimps, yeah.
That's so funny. How do you relate to a mongoose?
It's this weird thing where if you spent time with an animal and I'm talking, weeks, months, years, and you're spending hours and hours every day out there watching those animals, you start to think like the animals, you start to read the landscape like the animals. in terms of where there are threats, where there are opportunities, and in terms of appreciating the interactions between individuals within groups and just reading what behavioral cues between individuals mean. So you literally start to think like a mongoose.
I love that. You mentioned taxonomic bias.
Yeah.
We tend to be attracted to or drawn to animals that we can see ourselves in or are more similar to us. That makes sense with chimpanzees. But what about things like tigers and pandas that have seemingly drawn a lot of our attention when you think of like the most famous animals?
Yeah, we might need a psychologist to answer that specifically. I mean, if I start in general terms, the thing to say there is that they are relatively large mammals.
Right.
They're both carnivores in terms of their taxonomy, although obviously pandas are weird carnivores because they are vegetarian.
Famously love bamboo.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, it's an interesting thing. We tend to focus our attention and we tend to historically have focused conservation attention on relatively large mammals.
Hmm.
Now, what are the reasons for that? The reasons are that I suppose they're more visible to us. And Benji, you know, having researched and written about pandas, about why pandas are special. So maybe I should be asking you the panda question. But if I take tigers and other large carnivores, if we think about human history and selection pressures, they are one of the few taxonomic groups or animal species which are a major threat to our lives. And so we've had good reason historically for putting our attention towards them.
Right. One of the things I think about is whether this is really just about human perception or there's actually some scientific basis for valuing certain animals more than others. Like when you look at a panda, I mean, people joke about how they look kind of like evolutionary failures, like they're very lazy looking. Is our attention towards them mostly based in like human minds and psychology, or is there something about the tigers, the rhinos, and so forth that like scientifically makes them more important than other animals?
Yes, I think it is a bit of both. We are drawn to larger animals in terms of gaining our attention, but I think there is some logic ecologically, and I hesitate philosophically to talk about some animals or some species being more important than others.
Right.
And I suppose this is one of the points that we very much want to explore and investigate here, is that if we want to conserve planet Earth in the long term and the biodiversity that has evolved on planet Earth, then we ideally need to move away from focusing on endeavouring to conserve single individual species and actually think about conserving biodiversity holistically rather than looking to prioritise the conservation of particular individual species within that. So if we take large mammals and large carnivores, the impact that an individual within that species has on the ecosystem is larger than individuals within, for example, insects. So in that sense, if we get it right by identifying large species which hold large home ranges and which have relatively large impacts on the ecosystems that they occur within, then in that sense, there is some ecological sense in looking to conserve those species. What we're getting to there is thinking and talking about the differences between flagship species and umbrella species. In simple terms, definitions of flagship species and umbrella species. So flagship species is something which gains the publicity, which is used as a tool to raise awareness, to gain attention and support for conservation. Now, single species conservation in itself doesn't have to be bad for biodiversity if the species that we target for that conservation are species which work as umbrella species. And the concept there is that that species is acting as an umbrella and that it's sheltering a diversity of other species within the same habitat by doing so. There is some logic if we identify the right species to conserve, as long as they're the right species and as long as that conservation in doing so is conserving wider biodiversity.
Isn't raising awareness about animals a good thing for conservation? Who really cares if people get excited about one animal over another? Well, Jason does, and coming up after the break, he'll explain why.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
So we talked about how it seems like different animals do have different value or at least charisma in the minds of people, even of researchers in some cases. And so you do have like the pandas, the chimpanzees get a ton of attention, and then you have the mongooses. I mean, maybe the mongooses are not a good example because there are people like you who spend a lot of time studying them, but there are animals that are considered, I mean, they could be insects or whatever, less charismatic, less popular. And I guess my question is just like, so what? Does it matter so much that certain animals draw more attention than others? Does it matter that the panda has attracted so much attention, so much resources? Like, is that just a good thing? Because it's always good to put attention on species.
That's a really good point to make, actually. So if conservation biologists like me at times sound like we're being critical of saving certain species, I've come across this in the context, believe it or not, in the UK of, I've said things about grey squirrels, and some people have taken that to mean that I somehow want red squirrels to go extinct. That's not the way that I view the world. But a point to make there is that if we focus on some species and in doing so we lose other species, then ultimately we lose biodiversity, yeah?
Hmm.
So the argument here is that if we conserve pandas, and if pandas are not good umbrella species, i.e. if conserving pandas doesn't help to conserve other species within their geographical range, then we're going to lose the unique beauty and history and ecological value that those other species provide. So single species conservation ultimately can potentially not help other species. And I think with the way that the world's going, I don't think we have the luxury of saying, well, let's be selective in prioritizing the conservation of some species whilst simply accepting that other species will go extinct because we don't find them as interesting or as attractive or deem them to be as important. Because I think ultimately every species is important, whether we know it now or not.
So you can think of it kind of like a spotlight. If you're spotlighting certain species, other species in the ecosystem, obviously ecosystems are made of millions of parts. They might not get the attention, they might then decline, and we might not even know about those declines because we're just not putting our attention on those other species.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's relatively recent research which has shown that there are large carnivores that historically have shared habitats and geographical ranges with panda in China. And during a period of conservation success for the panda, we've seen very dramatic declines in those carnivore species. So that's indicating that panda conservation is working for the panda, but it's not operating to conserve effectively wider biodiversity. And you made a really good point there that we need to have the data to understand that. Now, looking at large carnivores like leopards, snow leopards, dholes, and wolves, they are being looked at. Okay, there will be all sorts of invertebrates and other more obscure species that we simply don't have the data on. So they're potentially invisibly disappearing. I think that if we want to conserve biodiversity, the way to do that is to conserve all species. So we either expand the single species approach to conserving every single species individually, or we take an approach where we look at conserving landscapes, ecosystems, habitats, areas.
Yeah. And I guess the broader context here that's important is just what conservationists have been doing hasn't totally worked. I mean, if you look at the data on species declines, on ecosystem destruction, it's not good. And so I guess I'm curious, like, do you see this single species approach as being part of the reason why conservation hasn't been more successful?
Yes, and I think we could have done and we could be doing conservation more effectively in terms of conserving a wider biodiversity.
Like, at the end of the day, conservation is a human endeavor. We have to make decisions about what we're protecting and how to protect it. At least I think that's true. I think we have to make those decisions. And so a big question I have is just, what exactly is it that we should be conserving? Is it animals for the sake of zoos? Like, I don't know, pandas seem like they're very much a zoo animal. Or, as you mentioned, like, we should really be focusing on wild landscapes, on ecosystems. Can you orient us a little bit in terms of just understanding how you even see, like, the purpose of conservation?
Yeah, certainly. I think it is one of those things that even different conservationists may give you different answers to that question. And certainly within the wider human population, you'll get different answers. I suppose this is the point, isn't it? I mean, we as a species, we're so dominant over the planet and the future of the planet and everything else that's in it, is that ultimately, as you say, it's what we want, what we think as a society, that ultimately will determine what else we share this planet with. And ultimately what our natural and unnatural landscapes will actually look like. So for me personally, as an ecologist, I think that the aim of conservation should be is to continue to have self-sustaining, interacting, evolving ecosystems in nature and to endeavor to have them and their components as intact and unperturbed by humans as it's possible to be, while accepting pragmatically that we have a growing and an increasingly demanding human population. That's why we need conservation, because we need to find effective ways to try to maximize the conservation of those functioning ecosystems in the growing challenges that we have. And you've already touched on the fact that, and it's impossible to say this without it being slightly depressing, that, you know, we're aware of these issues and the conservation movement has been endeavoring to positively conserve biodiversity for quite some time. But the stats, the figures that we see in the likes of the Living Planet report indicate that we're not going in the right direction. We're not succeeding at the level that we need to succeed. So that's why I think we're having conversations like this, is it's how can we most effectively utilize the resources that we have and how can we most effectively achieve those conservation goals.
I think it can be hard for people to understand the term ecosystem and functional ecosystem. Like, an animal is an animal. It's like a physical thing. We can see it. But when you talk about functioning ecosystems as what we want to sustain or restore, it's a little bit more opaque. What are some examples of that? Like, what does that actually look like?
So maybe the way to think about that is to think about habitats. So we have forest habitats, we have grassland habitats, we have mountain habitats, we have freshwater lake and loch habitats, we have marine habitats. And so these are environments that have characteristic structure, which is made up of the species that occur within them, and not just the animal species, but the plant species, the fungi, and the microorganisms that occur in those environments as well. And the logic here is that we continue to live on a very beautiful planet thanks to the biodiversity that we have and thanks to that diversity of environments, of habitats that we experience. We know that if we continue to lose habitat and we continue to lose species that both create and maintain those habitats, we're ultimately eroding that natural diversity. Now, that in itself, I think, is something that we have a moral responsibility to try to stop destroying it and to try to conserve it for the future.
And why should humans care about a grassland somewhere or the mongoose ecosystem that you study?
Yeah. So taking an anthropocentric perspective or a selfish human perspective in terms of why does any of this matter to us? What does it mean to us to have that over and above the intrinsic value that many of us gain from the natural environment? So when we talk about functioning ecosystems, we're ultimately talking about systems that clean the air that we breathe, that filter the water that we drink, that produce the pollinators that pollinate the crops that we grow, that ultimately leads to the foodstuffs for the livestock that populations eat. So, yeah, if we continue to erode nature and to degrade ecosystems, ultimately it's going to have rather unfortunate impacts on human populations and therefore human well-being within human populations.
Where do humans fit in to the ecosystems when we talk about a functioning ecosystem? Because I'm thinking about how people have lived in the U.S., for example, for millennia. There are many indigenous tribes. And I get a little bit confused with some of the terminology, because when we talk about, like, even if we're trying to create a functioning ecosystem, or some people say, like, a wild ecosystem or wildlife, the term wild itself is confusing to me, because is that supposed to mean a lack of humans? But if that's true, then what about indigenous people? Like, how do you think about just the way that humans are a part of the environment and how that affects our definitions of things like wild landscapes and so forth?
In terms of the philosophy of nature conservation and the history and future of nature conservation, if I can bring the word rewilding into the conversation. So rewilding is a relatively recent term, but it's a term which has gained quite a bit of positive momentum, because it's a pretty positive outlook in terms of how we do conservation. So in a nutshell, rewilding refers to ecosystem restoration. So repairing and restoring ecosystems, and essentially to make them more biodiverse and to make them more functional where they've been historically damaged by human populations. And I think often there is a misunderstanding or a perception that rewilding means dehumanizing, i.e. removing or emptying human impacts on landscapes. Ultimately, rewilding is trying to help and encourage nature from where we are right now. And there are various ways in which we can go about doing that. But I think it's important to acknowledge that ultimately, ecosystem restoration, conservation, it's not about removing humans from the landscape. It's ultimately about allowing the human population to benefit from biodiversity in nature that is there, or that we can encourage to be there.
According to Jason, we need to be focusing on saving entire ecosystems, not just single species. But how is that different than what we're doing now? Coming up after the break, we'll discuss the current approach to conservation and where it falls short.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
So we started out talking about individual species, animals, and how conservation has focused a lot, at least in the last 50 years or so, on protecting these individual species, the pandas, the rhinos, the tigers, and so forth. And then you've shifted us to thinking about how we should really be focusing on creating functional ecosystems or sustaining functional ecosystems. We've talked about what some of those can look like. I'm just wondering, where do things stand in the conservation movement today? Do people agree on what needs saving? Do people generally agree with what you've said so far in terms of we need to just be focusing on ecosystems instead of species? Like, where are we right now?
Yeah, I think in general terms, there's been a movement towards landscape scale conservation or ecosystem restoration, as we've just been discussing. Once again, I think single species conservation has its role, okay? Because people, as we've discussed, psychologically, people tend to associate and relate more to individual species, particularly charismatic ones, versus thinking about a habitat or an environment. Okay, so I think single species conservation still has a role to play. I think we can do it more effectively, and we've talked about umbrella species versus flagship species in that context. But yeah, I think this appreciation that it's important for us to endeavor, and I think we are, as a field, as a movement, I think conservation biology is becoming more effective at looking to conserve biodiversity and ecosystem function. We clearly still have lots of room for improvement in terms of increasing the effectiveness of us doing it, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
But like, how do we know what wild is? Like, how do we, is this just looking back in history to see what used to be there, or are we using other kinds of scientific tools to understand like what a functioning ecosystem looks like?
I think those words can mean different things to different people. Yeah, I come back to this point that, again, this is a point that's often raised with regards to rewilding, is that rewilding is about trying to take an environment back to some previous point in time and history. Now, I think there's an element of that. I think there's an element of wanting to know what used to be in an area or in a habitat before humans have had a major impact on that habitat or area. So I think that's useful in terms of thinking about what that habitat would look like, or if we're looking to restore a habitat, that helps to inform us. But I don't think we should be tied to trying to recreate extinct ecosystems simply for the sake of it. So, you know, do we bring back mammoths? Do we bring back dinosaurs? I mean, you know, what are we trying to recreate? So I think conservation generally is much more pragmatic than that. And again, I come back to this point that what is wild? Well, wild is where we have more nature than what we have at the moment. If we can make places wilder, whether they're already what places we think of as being wildish, or whether they're places that are urban or somewhere in between, I think the general goal and aim to make the world a better place for everybody is to make it more wild, to have more wildlife, to have more nature. So that's not necessarily about trying to bring it back to being, you know, what it was at the end of the last ice age or whatever.
Yeah. And not to be annoying, but nature, like, do we just mean non-human life?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So this relates to a point you brought up earlier as well. And actually, if I may say so, in your Vox article regarding the pandas recently, I think there's a lot of really interesting points there about ex situ conservation. So basically about how we treat and manage wildlife.
Yeah, yeah.
Out with wild places. So we're talking about zoos and captive breeding and the likes. Again, for me as an ecologist, what is wild? Wild is wildlife, or what is nature? Nature is it's the biotic elements of our environment, but it's them being out in the environment. It's not having them caged in a zoo or in a museum. It's actually having functional ecosystems, wherever they may be, but actually functioning as naturally as they can be.
Yeah. And so then, do you see zoos as, I mean, zoos are kind of marketed as tools for conservation, especially today. I know there are critics of that idea that they could be for conservation, but if zoos are not nature because it's not the natural environment, I know the vocabulary here is tough. Do you see animals in a zoo as something different than nature?
Yes. They're wild animals, but they're not in the wild. So zoos have a role to play. Good zoos have a role to play in supporting in situ conservation. So that's conservation of wild animals in the wild. But I struggle to think of a world where we see conserving wildlife is actually simply having those animals, those species living in zoos and not actually living in the wild. I struggle to see the point in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, to me, we've lost something. We've lost a battle if actually our aim is simply to have species existing but only existing in zoos. Then why are we doing that, other than to give us something to look at and to learn what we've destroyed in nature, in the wild? So to my mind, I would love to live in a world where we don't need to have zoos, where our wildlife is in the wild.
Yeah. And then also, I'm just thinking about the experience of people in zoos too. Obviously, like, zoos are for, in a sense, entertainment, and how that compares to being outside in a natural environment. And so a lot of us live in this strange reality where to see wildlife is to go to a zoo and not walk out to our backyard. And it's interesting in the context of this conversation, because I'm like, all right, when we go to the zoo, we're not seeing nature. We can see nature in our yard potentially, but we don't see it as such often. I think. I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I think that's a very perceptive observation. Again, good zoos play an important role in terms of education, in terms of raising awareness, educating people about biodiversity, about ecology, and about conservation. So that's an important role. But I think you're right. I think there's an underappreciation of nature in many cases. I just feel that biodiversity itself deserves to be out there in the natural world rather than it being something that we view in a catalogue, whether that be an artificial environment that we're conserving it with. So that has a role to play because of the state that the planet's in. And I'm pragmatic enough to know that that's a necessity because of the state of the world's biodiversity. I don't think we should see conservation as having succeeded if that is simply in having a wild species still in existence, but actually only existing in captivity.
Right, right. No, I agree. Obviously, it's a privilege that you've been able to travel and spend so much time in an environment that's so different than the one you grew up in. But I'm wondering if our listeners, if just everyone can have more appreciation for nature without having to travel so far. Like, are there ways that we can experience some of these ecosystems and the interactions therein without going very far? Is nature closer than many of us might think?
So I think, again, as I said at the beginning, you know, I feel like I've been an ecologist all my life, and that's in large part to my experiences when I was growing up and being able to go out and enjoy local nature reserves. So nature is all around us if we are perceptive enough to observe it. Now, again, I still think we can have more nature around about us within urban environments. We can do more to facilitate and encourage that. But everybody can have biodiversity accessible within their life. I mean, nature always finds a way, or tries to find a way, even in the most urbanized of habitats. There will be what we think of as weeds trying to grow up through the cracks in the pavement. There will be that abandoned backyard. There'll be that industrial lot that's been derelict for a while. There'll be a river, a stream, or a burn running through. There'll be a lake or a loch, or you'll have access to the coast. Nature finds a way, even if it's not massively obvious nature to us. Okay, so we've very much in our conversation, we've been guilty of taxonomic bias, and that we've mostly talked about mammals and vertebrates. And a taxonomic group I want to bring forward, which is probably never going to be a flagship species group, but arguably is an umbrella species group, are the earthworms.
Okay, tell me about earthworms.
Well, earthworms, I mean, soil is so important to everything. We've talked about habitats, okay? I mean, ultimately, whether we have trees growing or shrubs growing or grasses growing or flowers growing, the soil, the composition of the soil is a major part of that. Soil is very much the coming together of the abiotic and the biotic elements of the environment. And earthworms are invertebrates, which are ecosystem engineers. They play a major role in aerating the soil and in helping to break down and recycle organic material, and therefore make nutrients available for vegetation to grow within the soil. Now, we walk on top of the soil and we walk over and around earthworms all the time. Okay, that's an example of a taxonomic group that we're generally blind to.
I know that there are obviously issues focusing on single species, but I love the idea that if not the panda as a flagship species, as the iconic endangered animal, then maybe it's the earthworm that we can redirect our attention to.
I would love to see that. I'd love to see the earthworm being the, you know, the poster, the poster animal going forwards for conservation. That tends to not happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, even in our own environments, going out and looking for the small things. So, you know, look on leaves, look, get down on the ground, look at the plants, look on the surface of the soil, and you'll start to appreciate the organisms that are there.
Yeah. So I'm a pessimist, and I spend a lot of my time reading and writing about environmental issues. Often the stories are negative. We've talked about biodiversity loss as a problem, some of the issues with conservation and ways that it's changing. Do you have anything that's going to make me and our listeners hopeful about the future of wildlife as someone who's not used to getting a big dose of hope?
I'm also a pessimist, Benji, so oh, no. I'm not necessarily oh, no. the best person to ask for a positive response to that question. Well, science is about collecting data in order to facilitate understanding. Okay, and so science continues to do that job. And the more knowledge and understanding that we have of the way the world works, the way in which we're damaging the world, but also importantly, the way in which we can endeavor to mitigate or reverse that damage, then the better future we'll have for biodiversity and for ourselves as human populations. So I'm very encouraged by the fact that we're continuing to do good science, we're continuing to learn. We're continuing to evolve in the context of how we go about doing conservation biology. And then amongst other things, it also includes the communication of science. So, you know, I'm very grateful also to have the opportunity to be able to talk to you and the listeners about these things in a way that historically scientists would not necessarily have been able to do. And so I certainly think there's hope. I think there's hope from science, there's hope from the general population. But in amongst all that conservation optimism, I think we also have to acknowledge the limits and the patterns of biodiversity loss are not good. And so we need to do more than we're doing. We need to put more emphasis and resources into biodiversity conservation, and we need to be more effective in how we use the resources that we have.
Yeah.
Which is what this conversation has ultimately all been about, isn't it?
Yeah, more airtime for earthworms. Jason, thank you so much for coming on. It was such a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Patrick Boyd engineered this episode, Alex Overington wrote our theme music, and AM Hall is the boss. Special thanks to my good friend, Caitlin Boguki. If you want to learn more about pandas and how it's a success story nested in a much sadder tale, check out the story I wrote for Vox. It's called We Pulled Pandas Back from the Brink of Extinction. Meanwhile, the rest of nature collapsed. Let us know what you think about the episode. Drop us a line at thegrayarea@vox.com. And if you appreciated this conversation, please share it with your friends. Sean Illien will be back with another episode on Thursday.